services for the last 18 years. 7 years before that, I did emotionally disturbed and behavior conflicted adolescent programs. I've been here in Montgomery also teaching adjunct at Faulkner, which is probably why you noticed I gave you homework last night. Like my students, you probably didn't do it. That's okay. I expect that, and I'll pick up where we left off and bring you up to speed. So being a social worker, being an educator, and being a parent has taught me many things. Now, on night two, I do want to throw in a big disclaimer. If you hear me talking as if I know anything, I want you to understand it's because I want you to feel confidence in me. I want you to develop trust that what I'm saying is beneficial. But I don't want you to think I'm the source of all knowledge. That is not the case. I will freely admit anything I say that is good, that is right, that works, I got from the Bible or I stole from somebody that I saw doing it that was ahead of me in the developmental cycle of a family. In going to Dalreda and having children born while we were here, I looked around to families with children 6 or 7 years older and watched. When did they let them sit with the youth group? When did they make them sit with the family? How much independence did they give them? I watched these families and said, does that look like it's working? If it did, I used it. If it didn't, I threw it out. I want you to do the same thing in these 4 nights. Anything that's good, that's useful, I'm not taking credit for it. I stole it from somewhere, and so I offer it to you freely. Pass it on to other people. If it doesn't work or it's counterproductive, then please forget that I ever said it and don't do it. You are the best judge, according to the Bible, of meeting the needs of your family, okay? But I'm not up here saying, I've got the answers, I'm doing it right, I know everything. I am not. I'm saying I have a lot of experience in working with families and children. I've tried hard, and I am mindful of what I'm doing the majority of the time, which leads to analyzing things and trying to come up what is best. That's what I will take credit for, but nothing else, all right? In thinking about last night, we had Joseph, and Joseph was a person of power. If you will turn with me to Genesis chapter 45, Genesis chapter 45, verses 17 through 20. We will set the stage for what your children are learning tonight and what we are going to be studying. It says in Genesis 45, 17 through 20, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go to the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. Now you are ordered, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. And do not concern yourselves with your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. Now that's an offer he couldn't refuse. And it is part of God's plan. You might say, no, fast forward, you're going to be slaves. It's going to be hard, you're going to be oppressed. Sometimes people say, I don't want to have children. Why not? I don't want them to live in this world that's just getting worse and to be, you know, around when we see what happens. I laugh and go, my parents didn't think that, and I'm here, it's getting worse. I don't care. I won't be around to see it. Have kids, have grandkids. Let them deal with what comes. They need to be here because we need them to be lights in this world. Now, if some people say, I don't want to bring a child into this world of suffering, that is their choice. I personally think if you're saying it's going to be hard on them, maybe we're not trusting God enough. It's okay to have kids and to know that they're going to have kids, Lord willing, one day, and that they'll have kids. The world will go on. There will be marriages and giving them marriages up until just like the day Noah closed, God closed the door and the rain started with Noah until the second coming, these things will be happening. So it's okay. So I laugh and look at my kids and say, I'm not here to make your life better than mine and to give you everything I didn't have. I didn't have it. You can survive without it too. And they said, we got the wrong set of parents. And I'm like, you're right. You must have. Oh, we wish we had other parents. I'm like, keep wishing. Let me know how that works for you. It hadn't changed anything as far as I know. Reality is still, I'm their father. They have the mother that I married and those are our kids. Tough. Deal with it. So the children of Israel had a great idea, and it was wonderful, and they were favored. Let's move forward about 400 years. Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Things got tough, but God had a plan. Or should I say, and God had a plan. Sometimes we say this and this and this, but, and it negates everything that came before. Try replacing the word but in your vocabulary with the word and see if it doesn't fit better. Things got tough. There was someone that did not know Joseph and didn't give him special attention. And God had a plan for this. The plan was to show Egypt that their gods were nothing compared to the one true living God. It was to have the children of Israel grow into a mighty nation in a sheltered environment to a degree, and then to go through the hardships to appreciate what God was going to give them, and then for them to see God keeps his promises. That's what it was there for. You might say, smooth seas do not good sailors make, and you still might say, I don't care, give me smooth seas, I won't be a great sailor. They needed the hardship to temper them into the nation they needed to be. So you know how the story goes. The midwives were told, leave the baby girls alive, kill the baby boys. But the midwives would not do that. They said, they've already given birth. The Hebrew women don't need us. They give birth too quickly. We can't get there. So the soldiers were told to kill the male children so that the resistance from the Hebrews would not be greater than the Egyptians. Let's look at chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Chapter 2, 1 through 4. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Moses was not put in the basket and pushed off to the middle of the stream and sent out to sea. He was not sent for a ride. He was put near the shore in the reeds where he wouldn't float away, and he was to be found. He wasn't to be hidden. It was, I believe, his intention, his mother's intention, for him to be found, but in a way that would save him, not condemn him. She didn't put him where the soldiers could find him. She put him in the area where one of Pharaoh's daughters, was likely to go. And his sister Miriam stood watch over him. Let's read verses 5 through 8. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. You see right there that they walked along the bank for a ways. It wasn't just, wow, wasn't it lucky that they went to that one spot and found that basket and went back? This was a routine that she had. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. How did she know that? The Hebrews looked different from the Egyptians. We're going to find out later on, Moses maintained an identity based on what he looked like, and he identified with the people in the nation from whence he came. We're also going to touch on the fact that people without identities, without a family or without a nation or without something that they identify themselves with, they're going to find themselves unattached. And if you're unattached, you find it hard to trust. So it's obvious that there are differences. Pharaoh's daughter knew this was a Hebrew child. And in verse 7, it said, "Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go ahead.' So the girl went and called the child's mother." The nobility at that day and time did not want to nurse the babies and lose their figures. They would hire somebody to do that, even to the point where some cultures had the royalty either half-bared or totally topless at times to show, "Look, I still have my figure, even if I have children. I didn't nurse them. I can afford not to. You had to." So a wet nurse was one that actually still had milk or had nursed another child and then could keep nursing someone else's child. I've known women that adopted so closely after they had had a baby, and the baby that they gave birth to was just being weaned. When they adopted, they were able to nurse their adopted child. Not to say, "Look, I'm pretending that the baby's mine." We're going to get into the fact that Moses knew he was adopted. And tomorrow, we're also going to talk about Hannah, Elizabeth, women who waited their whole lives for children, and how they handled finally getting the blessing of having a child, and how some women who were never blessed with conceiving a child still followed God and trusted in him. In this case, Pharaoh's daughter said, "Sure, I would like someone to nurse him and even keep him for me during those first few years." Now, we today think, how sad to miss the first 3 years. Or maybe you're not a baby person. Maybe you're thinking, "Are you kidding? If I could afford it, I'd pay somebody to take my kid for the first 3 years and then give them back to me." You might say that's a blessing. Most people, though, want those first few years. On the other hand, you don't know exactly how important those first 3 years are. So we're going to stop for just a minute and say the gift that Moses' mother gave him was more than just a few years among his people. Because when we get to verse 10, "And the child grew and was turned over to Pharaoh's daughter." The bonding and attachment cycle of a child begins by that child hearing the mother's heartbeat in utero, the sounds that are there. At birth, the child has a connection that is then built upon. And the idea of bonding and attachment is such an important one, because the very first stage of childhood development, which we will be studying in our next few lessons, the very first stage is always trust. If you do not have trust as the basis of a relationship, you do not have a relationship. I hope you automatically see that I'm going to take this over the next few lessons to our trust in God. And it's a slam dunk. God is all powerful. God cannot lie. God will not fail us. That's what we call trust. If I could say that to one other person in this world just once, I would consider myself a huge success. But there is nobody that I can look at and say, "I've never failed you. I've never lied to you. I've never let you down." Whether it was unintentional rather than intentional. So why would somebody trust me? Well, maybe I have more going for me in those relationships than not, so we can build trust and develop trust. But with God, the trust is always there. Remember that. With a child, how does the child learn this trust? It's simple. The child doesn't learn trust in a vacuum. There were studies done 70 years ago where there were so many infants in an orphanage, all they could do was feed the babies 4 times a day and change them 4 times a day, swaddle them in a blanket, keep them warm, and put them back in their crib. Half of them died. Died. They were changed. They were fed. They were given medical attention. They died from lack of affection and attention. 25%, half of the ones that survived, never could form normal relationships. So what happened to the other 25 that could? I think it's either, is it Wednesday or Thursday? It's Wednesday or Thursday. Come back for both. We will cover the stages of development and temperament and personality and maybe explain why some of these things are different for some children. Briefly, last night, I talked to you about birth order. And some of you identified with that and said, that's exactly true. Some of you said, that wasn't exactly true. That's true. There are variances in how birth order affects different kids, even though there's some general principles. Tonight, bonding and attachment, I'm going to give you the standard operating procedure for how it works. And I know you know there's some exceptions to that. Wednesday or Thursday, whenever I fit in the temperament and personality, we will talk about what things help or hinder children and parents in their relationship. So I'm not ignoring it. I'm not unaware of it. I'm just leading up to it. When you take that baby in your arms, I sit in the back of the church building when we stand and sing. You can't just stand, you have to stand and sing. When you stand and sing, I look around and you have the people that twist from the hips. Personally, I think it's great to work these muscles right here. There's a baby in their arms, all right? You have some that do this, the forwards and the backwards. They bend at the knees and they're doing like this. Why not say, hey, hold that baby still. You need to hold that baby still. Don't move it at all. Babies that are held still are insecure because they don't know what's going on. They can't sense things around them. You also don't want to put a string on them and treat them like a yo-yo, okay? You're not going to, you know, woo, he said movement was good for a baby. Let's get on the trampoline. No, all things in moderation, people. The baby needs to understand I'm moving and I'm moving and I'm moving and I'm safe. I'm safe, I'm safe. Over and over and over, moving and swaying with a child teaches trust and security. Not through protecting them and watching them starve emotionally and die, and not through being rowdy with them. I do not think babies or puppies need to be used in a game of catch. You've seen some people walking around hurt for the rest of their life, that it happened to them or that they did it to someone. I will step in and go, whoa, no, can't do that. Not good. I will get in your business if that happens. Other than that, you can raise your child basically the way you want to. But we need that security. What else do they need? They need to be fed. The baby has this feeling of just churning and burning, and it's horrible. And it screams, and it gets that quivering in the voice, and you're like, make it stop. So you feed the baby the bottle, or you nurse the baby. And it's amazing, whether you're nursing or feeding a bottle, a baby's vision develops very quickly at about 10 inches. That's here to here, your eyes to their eyes, when you're holding them and feeding them. That's what they can see. And they respond to a human face. Eye, mouth. They will pick that out and their eyes will gravitate towards that and they develop that vision and they know you're there. And then you do this and you put them down or you do this over here and you pick them up and they see that again and they smile. Smiles are important. Anytime you see a child in this building or anytime and you make eye contact with them, zing them with a smile. There's some kids that don't want it, but you can give them that smile and that eye contact, and it gets in past their defenses. They might scowl and turn away, but usually they're going to smile back at you. Get them with a smile when they're not looking every single time. It's that important. So we have the rocking motions for safety. We have the food that they're getting to satisfy themselves. We have the smiles. We have the eye contact. We have the consistency. The cuddling, skin on skin, is important to a baby too. The child's brain is basically undeveloped at birth. All the brain cells are there, the neurons are there, and they're developing and developing, and they'll continue to develop for the first year or so. Then they start to plateau. So if they haven't been built by then, you're going to stay with what you have. And then they're going to start kind of paring them off, and paring as in pruning. All right, not two, but just cutting off some of the ones that aren't used. And if it's not hardwired by that time, it's not going to be wired. You do miss some opportunities after the first year and after the third year to have brain development and to help hardwire your children that you won't get back. So I studied this before I got married. I was like, I can do this. We decided to have a child, and that was good that we decided, and things were going as planned, and then all of a sudden I realized, wow, she's pregnant, and we're going to have a baby. I was totally unprepared. But I started thinking, what do I remember? And it's like, get them while they're young. Get them while they're defensive. Train them. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do that. Every day I came in from work, I spoke the same sentence, the same two sentences to my baby through my wife's stomach. And I spoke it every day. When it came time for that baby to be born and he was delivered, first of all, I saw 10 toes, 10 fingers, a baby. The cry was wonderful. And I said, the baby's here. My wife, I mean, what's she supposed to go? Really? I was like, I was impressed. I was surprised. I was shocked. And so when I went to hold her face, they said, it's a boy. And I about dropped her head because they'd been telling us it was a girl. I didn't check boy or girl. I checked healthy baby. I was proud of myself on that one. And I was like, what? And they're like, yes. I said, oh, sweetheart. And so, you know, we just shared a moment there. And he was crying up a storm. They put him in the incubator. And at 2 minutes old, I noticed this baby's crying. And this sound, I was like, wow. I turned and spoke those same two sentences that I'd spoken to him. And he stopped crying. He lifted his head, turned it towards the sound of my voice, put his head down, and just looked at me. And the doctor and the nurses freaked out. And they said, what did you just do? I said, it's called conditioning, and I'm going to use it for all it's worth. If you can train your child like you would a good German shepherd, you got a good thing going. Now, don't use the newspaper or anything that's inhumane, but it has been shown. Some people train their animals better than they do their children. I don't know if you know this or not, but I trained my kids right now. If they're in this auditorium, I give a special whistle, and they stop, and they turn, and they look. If I give it twice, I don't want you to stop and look. You better get over here now. I started that when they were 2 or 3 months old. They don't even hear it sometimes. And people standing next to me don't hear it, and they're like, oh, here he is. I'm like, yeah, I called him. We did it for the first one. We did it for the second one. When we discovered we were about to have our third one, my wife's first question was, how am I going to take care of three and get my energy back? And oh, no. And mine was, got to come up with another call. And every now and then, you know how you call someone by the wrong name, and you're like, no, I didn't mean that? I'll give a whistle, and they'll say, yeah, and I'll go, no, not you, and I'll give the other one. And if I hit it all three at a time like this, it means supper. You better get in here. I started it because I knew what you do with a baby in those first few years is irreplaceable. I also knew that one day they would not care a rat's tail what I had to say. They wouldn't want to be around me. They would reject everything if I said it. So what do? I say less. They're like, well, yeah, I'm going to be against everything you say. And I said, okay, watch this. They're like, well, say something so I can be against it. I'm like, I got nothing. Do what the Bible says. That's not fair. I can't fight the Bible. I told them I'm the biggest cheater there is. If you're going to go against me personally and do this, that, and the other, I'm going to take myself out of the fight and say, I trained you according to this. I've heard a parent's prayer go something like this. Lord, let me be there every day for my children that I can be there. And when I can no longer be there for them, put people around them that will keep them headed towards you. It's awe-inspiring that some parents have told me, we've prayed that prayer. Thank you for being our answer. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they said, you treat our kids like they're your own. I was like, oh, I was so worried about my kids and taking care of them, I didn't realize it. I've been parenting your kids when they're not around you. And they're like, yeah. And I said, well, appreciate you taking care of mine when they're at your house too. It's a great feeling to have family reaching out. And you're like, what's all this got to do with Moses? This is what his mother did. For those 3 years, she nursed him, nurtured him, gave him consistency, stimulated his mind to where his brain grew. And if she hadn't, what would have happened? He would have been bitter. He would have been distrustful. He would have been shy. He would have been hesitant. He would have been fearful. But she made him, check this out, in the 3 years or so that she had him, she made him into a man that 40 years later stood up for what was right. That's what I call some good parenting. My kids are not 40 yet, but every now and then, well, not now because they're too big, they hear me come in the room. When they were smaller, I used to, you know, put them to bed, and when they would go to sleep, I'd say, I want you to marry a Christian. Marry somebody that will treat you as good as I do or better, and if you like them, I have no problem with them. I've given up that fight. Some people say, aren't you afraid of who they'll marry? Do I have any control over it, really? I think not. I don't fight fights where I have no control. Put two hands behind my back and I'm not going to fight. I'm going to run. But I look at them and I say, guess what? Your choice. You know the right thing to do. And yes, I use subliminal messages. I used unconscious conditioning. I'm telling you, people, you got to take advantage of the early years and stick with it. Here's one more trick, and then we'll move on. No matter what the age of your children is, just look at them and think something. Just look at them and go, in your head, I really love you. I like the way you did that. You're a wonderful person. Don't say a thing. And they'll go, what? And you go, nothing. What? What? And I'm like, me? No. And they're like, quit it. You're doing it again. Doing what? Whatever it is you're doing, then you're making me feel uncomfortable. And I'm like, well, good. That's my job. Okay? Your thoughts towards your children and your grandchildren don't even have to be spoken. They can be powerful if they just come from the heart, because you're going to act on them. In nonverbal, it's 93%. The other 7% is verbal. Do you think I'm just up here using verbal? I'm using everything I have, and I'm taking from you as well. And this is an interactive relationship. Wake up and smell the roses. Life is inclusive. And Moses' mother took those 3 years and filled him with love and attention and rocking and food and smiles and contact. And then she said, he's alive by the grace of God. I will now turn him over, because he wasn't killed when he was an infant. Let's look at Exodus 1:10. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses, because I drew him out of the water. For 3 years, Moses' mother called him by his Hebrew name. Moses' mother met his adoptive mother. The princess met the birth mother of Moses, and they now had a relationship. He saw these two maternal figures connect. Before I go past the nurturing and the bonding and attachment, my mother does daycare. God bless her heart. She's in her late 60s, dad retired, and he thought he'd have peace and quiet. They have their grandkids over, which are about 7 of those that live in and around the area. In addition to that, 3 1-year-olds, 3 2-year-olds, 4 3-1s, 3 2s, and 4 3s. Plus, when school's out, their older brothers and sisters come over. And that's what she does. She tells the parents, I'm giving them consistency and trust during the day. Here's how I'm doing it. Be sure to do that for them at night, and they are growing. You don't have to have a mother be the only one in your life to have bonding and attachment. You need the consistency, the predictability, and you need a primary caretaker that is a partner with anybody else that's in your child's life, and you need to be on the same page. All right? You don't have to have it perfect. It doesn't have to be one person. All right? So Moses was adopted. And then in Exodus 1:11, it says, now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. See, Moses had identity. He looked out on his people. Why are they his people? Didn't he have 37 years in Pharaoh's palace? Didn't he know how to worship Ra, Isis, Osiris, Anubis, Bast, all the Egyptian gods and goddesses? Didn't he go to those temples and those things? Didn't he dress like them? Didn't he act like them? The answer to that is yes, because in a minute, when he's in the wilderness and he sees his wife-to-be, she goes home and reports, an Egyptian helped us out. Well, what is he? In this verse, he's an Egyptian on the outside, but he's a Hebrew on the inside because he sees his brethren, the Hebrews, being tasked and beaten. Then when he gets into the desert, he's a Hebrew on the inside, but looks like an Egyptian. So his identity, Moses had a lot to deal with. It said, so he looked this way and that in verse 12. And when he saw that there was no one around, let that be a lesson. My mom said, oh, there's always someone around. I said, yes, ma'am. You mean God? She said, him too. But I mean, someone will rat you out. I don't care how smart you are, how clever you are. I don't care what you do. Someone will always find out and they'll always tell me and I will always know. So deal with it. First of all, she was right. And second of all, just because she planted that thought when I was young enough, I believed her. So whenever I did something bad or wrong, I just waited for mom to find out. And she did. And then I came and we had a discussion about it. It didn't stop me from doing everything, but at least I knew my mom would know. Maybe it stopped me from a few things, okay? But he said no one was looking. He struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. The next day, it was already all over town. Ooh, watch out for Moses. He'll kill you. And they said, you're not our prince, you're not our judge. And Moses had to flee because in the next verse, Pharaoh knew about it and wanted to kill him. Moses had a conflict on the inside. He looked Hebrew. He had dark skin. He had a larger nose. He probably had the very black hair. He was recognized at birth as a Hebrew baby. He grew up a Hebrew in Egyptian clothing. He was, I don't know if he was going to be Pharaoh one day. Let's not go that far. But he was going to be powerful if he stayed the course. Why didn't he stay the course? I don't know. I think it had something to do with the care and attention he got from his mother during his early years. It also was that God had a plan for him, and God was preparing Moses to know Egyptian law, to know Egyptian culture, to know the things that he was going to come back and face in 40 years. Talk about on-the-job training. When Moses appeared in Pharaoh's court, it was not the same Pharaoh that he fled from, because God was going to tell him, the ones who sought your life were dead. Isn't it nice that God in the Old Testament and even beginning in the New Testament would come and say, hey, the ones that wanted you dead aren't there. You can go back now. I think that's good. That's called providence. When Moses went back to Pharaoh's court, it was a different Pharaoh, but he already knew what the court was like. He had been in that courtroom. He knew the laws. He knew the culture and the customs. But by that time, he had re-identified himself as a Hebrew. You might be, oh, that's great. No, there's one place in between where he lost it. He almost lost his life. He almost lost his life for forgetting his religion. That's called a teaser. That's to keep you interested for 10 minutes till we get to it. All right. So you might think we are going to talk about adoption tonight. We're actually going to talk about adoption more tomorrow night. We're talking about identity tonight. What was it that made Moses feel like he was a Hebrew and he should take up for his Hebrew people? Some of it was the way he looked. Some of it was his national identity. He could have chosen Egypt, but he didn't feel connected. Right now, if I ask everybody in here that was raised in a biological family, that wasn't adopted, that might not know your background, but the ones from a biological family, if I said, are you only an American? Do you only know that you were born in whatever town or city you were born in? if you were born in this country, or what country you were born in, but do you only claim one country as of this one moment without any idea of your past? I don't think you could say that. You know if you're Scottish, Irish, English, African American. You ever been there? Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. But right now, what if you didn't have that? And why is it so important to you? Why do you even care? Why not let it go? You don't live in those countries. You haven't lived in those countries. You have a citizenship in one country. Why not make that the only country you care about or identify with or know? Because you want an identity with a cultural and an ethnic background, because identity is so important. Now, children that are adopted, abandoned at birth, and don't have that information, when they get to school and everybody's talking about, so what are you? Is that how we say it? So what are you? I'm a human. No, where are you from? Montgomery. No, before that, I wasn't around. But everybody wants to know. Identity. That's why the Hebrews, the Israel nation, had their identity in God and Abraham, and they belonged. And Moses killed an Egyptian and then fled. So then let's look in chapter 2, unless we're still back in chapter 1. Nope, we're in chapter 2. Ask me how many times I've prepared this lesson and given it in my head. I lost count. It's a shame you guys are getting it just for the first time. That was chapter 2. Why don't we go on? When he fled into the wilderness in chapter 2, verse 19. Well, let's go all the way back up to 16. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" So they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." And he said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." And Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Moses couldn't be only a Hebrew. He couldn't be only an Egyptian. He was raised one way, but his heritage was the other way, so he was both. Why do we look at people and go, you can't be both? You can't be your mother and father's son and the husband of a family. You have to pick or choose. Well, I know we're supposed to cleave to our mates, but there's always a part of us that's connected to the family of origin, even when we have the family of procreation. Moses evidently looked like an Egyptian. And so he was brought in. He was made part of this family. Didn't say he had a wife or children in Egypt. This appears to be the first wife and first children that he had. And so for 40 years, he lived there and must have taught Zipporah something of his heritage, something of his religion. I think. You tell me when we move on just a little bit more. Let's go down to Exodus 3, 1 through 4. This is the second half, the first half of being drawn from the water and Pharaoh's daughter adopting him and his mother nursing him. That is what the children are seeing in the first part of their skit. The second half is the burning bush, and we've gone high tech. Instead of the crepe paper we used last time and a fan to make it burn, we now have a projector projecting flame onto a bush. Looks really good, okay? They've gone high tech. What do I know about high tech? I was using the crepe paper and a fan. But in chapter 3, verse 1, now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, "I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up." When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." And he said, here I am. Moses was about to become a Hebrew again, which actually means wanderer. Interesting. A Hebrew. God was calling him. Interesting story about all the excuses. You know what? God will find a way around every excuse you have. So I've learned another thing. When it comes to God, just get to the bottom line. Okay? He doesn't accept excuses. He finds a way. So if I start making excuses with God, I might as well just stop, go to the mirror, and make my excuses to myself, because they're no good. God doesn't listen to, I can't, I'm too this, or I'm not enough this. All right? I can kind of hear my mother's voice there and my father's. Are you done yet? No. Keep going. Okay. And now, are you done? No. Yes. Okay. Now, what are you going to do? What I'm supposed to? And they're like, shouldn't you have done that in the first place? I didn't want to. You're making it difficult on yourself? Maybe I am. You know, maybe we should be talking about my childhood, not me as a parent, but me as a child. But no, we don't want to go there either. I thought about those stories, and they are not pretty. Moses listened to God, made excuses. God honored some of Moses' excuses, and then in the end said, go. Now, if we look in chapter 4, verse 18 through 20. 4:18-20. Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. If God gives you a staff with which to perform miracles, don't lose it, okay? If God gives you the word of God in your hand, the complete and holy power, the dynamo, the dynamite of his word, don't leave it behind, figuratively or literally. Don't lose it, okay? So Moses went and asked permission of his father-in-law. He was respectful. I remember a day when I went to a man and I said, sir, sir, I would like to marry your daughter. He said, let's go in the front room. And I was like, can we stay here with the rest of the family? He said, front room. I said, yes, sir. Sat down with my father-in-law-to-be, and he said, what if I say no? I said, sir, I respectfully hope that that would not be your answer, and I cannot even conceive of that actually happening, could it? He said, what is your answer? I said, I don't know. I would have to think about that. I respect you highly, and your opinion counts. He said, son, what if I say no? I said, sir, I'm not sure. He said, there's only one answer. You respectfully tell me that it doesn't matter. She matters more, and you're going to do it. And I said, yes, sir. I respectfully, and I gave him the answer he gave me. He said, will you make her happy, and will you be happy? I said, yes, sir. None of this to the best of my ability, or I hope so. I learned from that man right then. You give him the answer. Yes, sir. He said, congratulations. That's a father-in-law. What do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to model myself after that. My kids are not in here right now. Do not spoil the surprise. I'm using those lines, okay? It's interesting. We're going to have to skip on, but thinking about in-laws, let me just say this. To the kids that aren't married or any adults that aren't married that are thinking about married, don't believe it when you or your friends say, I'm marrying him or her, not their family. It's a lie. It's a lie. You are marrying them and their family that's going to be coming around anyway, or not coming around and upsetting them. Their family and the way they were raised, your family and the way you were raised, are going to be a little topic of conversation to begin with when it's just one-on-one. But if you add a thing called a child, you will be face to face with, but we did it this way, but we did it that way, and there's going to be no way to resolve that except through prayer and a lot of discussion, because it's not going to be the way you were raised or the way they were raised. You are marrying their family. You better get to know their family, like their family. You're adopting them, they're adopting you. And the part that comes inside that spouse, even if you get away from the outside, if you move to an island, They're bringing their family with them in here, and you are too. Remember, I said go back and start on these kids when they're young and do the best you can. My kids had told me, there's some things you said that we can't forget even though we try and would like to. I'm like, really? And we've tried for a long time and we just can't. And I'm thinking, yes. And I go, well, I hope they're good things and I hope they work for you. There you go with that psychobabble stuff again. I'm like, excuse me, that's what I am. But you are marrying their family as well as them. Deal with it. We have just a few minutes left. Look down at chapter 4, verses 24 through 25. Now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Moses, yes, did you forget something? I got my donkey, I got my wife, I got my sons, I got the staff of God. No, I'm good, I didn't forget anything. God was waiting for him, and if Moses had showed up there the way he was, God would have killed him, is the way I read this. Then Zipporah, who must have paid attention to Moses at some point, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet, and she said, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." He had not circumcised his son. One of them, the other one, both of them, don't know. But one of them wasn't circumcised at least, and she took it, and I'm thinking, poor kid, that's terrible. Can you imagine, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? No, are we there yet? Wham, you're circumcised. Wouldn't ask that question again for the rest of my life. Okay, it's over, it's done. She circumcised him, and it says in verse 26, so he, God, let him alone. Don't neglect God's commandments. Don't forget them. Teach them to your wife, your husband. Teach them to your children. Don't rely just on yourself. You are a family. Be a family of God and know what he wants from you. It's that important. If I've heard it once, I've heard it 100 times. Again, my kids throw in my face, why do you always have to talk about Bible junk? We're sitting here trying to do something or talk to you, and you're always like, what does the Bible say? Well, the Bible says this. We're tired of that. Can't you do anything else? And I'm like, didn't realize I was doing it that much, but I must be doing something. So my answer is no. No, I can't do anything else. In fact, you just made me want to do it more. They're not the only ones who can be obstinate, and so I do it more. But we have to be always talking about this Bible stuff, okay? Saved Moses' life because his wife knew what to do. And then I think we're down to verse 29 through 31 of chapter 4. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Interesting. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses. That's what God said would happen. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. They got to see what happened at the burning bush. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped. Incredible response. Incredible. That's the power of God. That's the power of family. That's the power of the family of God. In the last 2 or 3 minutes, generationally, we're all in a different place. Moses had approximately 120 years. Let's just divide that into thirds. If we get 30 years in each of those and live to 90, if we divide them down, just look at the first part. You're a child, you're a follower, you're a dependent. Moses, during that time, remembered the teachings of his parents and was not ashamed to be a child and then an adult child who followed the word of God. That was the first of his life. Are we still in that stage? If we are, that's our job. Learn the word of God and follow the word of God so that when we are older, it will come out automatically in everything we do. And there's no shame in being dependent. Parents, though, are the next stage. You become husband and wife, father or mother maybe, a son-in-law, a daughter-in-law. You have individual choices. I will say here that I know some people that say, I need to get married. Why? Because my parents were married at this age, or someone else I know was married at this age. I say, Paul says in everything, be content. If you're single, you don't know how good you have it. And they're like, oh, you're married. And I'm like, yeah, and you don't know how good I have it. It's good on both sides of the fence. Just make sure when you change sides of the fence that you're ready to stay on your side. If you're not married, if you're married at 21 and you live to 81 and you celebrate 60 years, that's wonderful, isn't it? Hey, get married at 31 or 41 and celebrate 40 or 50 years. It'll seem like the same amount of time, okay? And I don't mean that in the bad way. What I mean is, when you're single, that's all you can think or comprehend. When you become married, you don't remember the single anymore, and you're married, and it's like you've always been married. So why are you rushing it? I know people that have said, well, I have to do this because I'm like, whoa, how's that going to work out for you? Well, it'll be okay. And I'm like, do not settle for okay. Don't ever settle for he treats me okay or she treats me okay. I looked around when I thought about getting serious with a girl and stopped and went, people around me say they wanted someone more attractive. If I want someone more attractive, I better decide that now. Looked around and decided, she's the most attractive. Got that one licked. What do I need in a relationship? What values do I have? If I have someone that does not have those same values, we're going to have conflicts. I looked around. She had those values. I didn't waste any more time. I asked her. She said yes, and here we are 26 years later. But I did my thinking ahead of time and said, if I'm going to want somebody else, if I'm ever going to regret this, if this isn't what I'm looking for, I'm not just going to settle for okay. It has got to be good, or I'm going to wait. I wonder if my kids know that. I don't think they know that story because it would get reinterpreted and I wouldn't look so good. Like, no, never mind. I'll stop with that example of what I said on my 25th anniversary. Didn't come out the way I meant it. Still apologizing for it. I guess I have 25 more and then I'll get it right the next time. Yeah, I said more than I needed to right there. So what I'm saying is this. Children, be children, become young adults. Know that the decisions you're making now will influence your life later, and know that's not fair, but that's the way it is. Young adults, young parents with kids, if you could do it all and then go back and do it again, you'd be awesome. Right now, just be good. All right, just knock it out. Do the best with what you have. And when you get older and you can offer this advice as a spiritual leader, a grandparent, a patriarch, and you can show that God's choices are indeed the right way, then do that for your family and for others. Because there are people in this congregation that I would not leave for any money in the world. While Dalreda is still a spiritual family like it is, I'm going to stay here because there are people here walking the walk, talking the talk, and living the right life. You're an example to me and my children, and I want to do that for others. But right now, I'm still learning from you all. I still feel like I'm new at this. Tonight's statement is the long run. Last night's was the legacy. Tonight is the long run. In fact, you probably didn't understand that legacy thing, so I'll read it, then I'll read the long run, and then we'll end. Because, I mean, these are too good just to use once. Legacy. Choices result in actions that shape choices that result in lives. The long run. Who we are depends mainly on whose we are and how we identify ourselves. Who we are depends mainly on whose we are and how we identify ourselves. That works for us as Christians. That works for our children until they can make that choice. And that has got to be our goal because that leads to heaven. We are done at this point. Teenagers, remember, get some snacks, and then I'll meet you up in the team room in just a few minutes. You know where it is. If you don't, follow somebody who does. If you have an infant or 2 or 3-year-old, go and get them. Get them now. Everybody else, continue to talk and wait for the children to come back in. I hope to see you tomorrow night. Thank you.